I feel there's a problem of lack of specificity in terms being used to refer to Majora's Mask. So what I want to mention is the sort of clarification I argue for. Great story versus great game. You can very broadly categorize a typical video game with any kind of story or setting as an immersive experience. To get the coveted sense of immersion, you need empathy with the game world, that is, a personal sense of connection, and feedback, that your actions within the game world make a difference, or in other words, narrative and engagement. The problem is, while working to the same goal, these are inherently contradictory design elements. Balancing these two is traditionally very difficult, depending on what you're doing. I've talked about this before in one of my Let's Play sections, so I'm able to just repeat and paraphrase what I said on the subject there. If you have a story that plays out in a given way, you can't expect to add a free-willed wildcard player to the experience and have it proceed as planned. Let's even imagine that you have the most immersed role-playing player imaginable, who is truly acting as their character would. You're still going to have moments where the player is thinking differently than the writers are, simply because the player is a wholly different person than the writers, and is bringing a completely different set of experiences and traits to the table. Much more likely, you'll get a player who is doing what sounds fun or interesting, and also probably completionists who want to see every possibility. Anyone who's played D&D, and especially anyone who's been a DM, will be familiar with this problem. You want to guide the players and make them feel like they're choosing what to do and how to do it, but if you want to tell a cohesive narrative with that free will built in, oh boy. Just look at Bruce Almighty for a good scene on that. Imagine how Tolkien's works would have gone and had Frodo, Fëanor, or Aragorn, for example, been under a player's control, and imagine yourself or people you know or have seen playing a game just in that role. Such a story would have had to either heavily railroad the player, thus crippling the sense of responsiveness, or give up entirely on a narrative that would have had to take into account, for example, the player trying to usurp the One Ring's power for themselves to use against Sauron. It's a rather amusing webcomic, long concluded, called DM of the Rings, that explores this very concept. It is important to mention that simulation, that is, having a world that reacts as a responsive virtual reality, is the ideal marriage of narrative and engagement. Modern games and computers of the present are increasingly able to incorporate this kind of thing. Like, for example, picture a very smart chatbot being behind every character of a game. However, while attempts at simulation are increasingly being made, players can tell that they're imperfect and not to mention are prone to being easily derailed to the enormous complexity that is instinctively known to humans but has to be hardwired into an AI, such as the infamous bucket glitch in Skyrim or virtually anything that comes out of Dwarf Fortress. So that explained Majora's Mask versus Ocarina of Time. Thor himself and the rest of the commentary have made it clear that the story and characterization of Majora's Mask is the feature of the game, not the, well, dungeons and what one would call the Zelda gameplay itself. I will argue that Majora's Mask has hands down the superior writing but inferior gameplay. The dungeons are torturously complicated or boring, usually both. Majora's Mask rewards exploration of the world and has a general tendency to offer the player more power or ease in task completion in exchange for taking the effort to 100% a given objective. Most obviously, the stray fairies in each dungeon. This also means that a player who wishes for upgrades or completionism has to spend more time combing the game world. That means a closer look at what the player is doing and what the environment is like. However, while that means that the player is more likely to appreciate, or hate, in the case of the dungeons, the world of Termina, but it also means that not only is the reward for extensive completion basically having an easier time with what you do next, and a player who can be a completionist in this game is already by necessity good at it, but it means that extensive backtracking or trial and error become necessary to find resources you need. In the modern day, we're used to GameFAQs, LPs, and the internet. Back when the game came out, there was the monthly Nintendo Power and Strategy guidebooks. How the hell was anyone supposed to find some of the things in Majora's Mask? For example, the Pirate's Fortress. This is probably my big example of what I find very wrong with the game. And trust, like, take it from me, I love the game, but Thorin's LP has definitely shown off the problems with it. But the Pirate's Fortress. Stealth section, that's not fun one bit. How do you basically ignore the stealth aspect, i.e. your reward for completionism, is to not have to play a terrible part? Get the stone mask. However, how in the hell are you supposed to find where the damn thing is? For one thing, it's in the canyon area, region 4, and the pirates are at the ocean, region 3. Until then, the game had never encouraged you to explore out of order, as getting into Snowhead required the arrows, and Great Bay required Epona. You couldn't really even do so previously. This is a bad thing. You may be protesting in responsibility right now with EPM. A player shouldn't need to be spoon-fed the idea of exploring the game world. And that is absolutely correct. However, the problem is, a player who had tried to do so before would have received the game's feedback of, you should explore this game area by area. A player being taught the wrong information by the game, and then being frustrated later by using that wrong information, is not the sign of a bad player, it's the sign of a bad teacher, so to speak. Maxwell Adams' LP of the game showed that you can branch out and explore by getting the fire arrows from Snowhead, to get the powder kegs, to get Epona, to access Great Bay, to get the Zora Mask, to get the hookshot, and you can even use the stone mask if you somehow know it exists to make getting said hookshot less of an ass pain, and then use the hookshot for the rest of Snowhead to make that temple much less annoying. Did you have the option to do that? Yes. Was it really worth that much sidetracking and effort? Maybe. And again, we're used to the internet and external information these days, but a game should never require that kind of thing. The entire point of a game is to ostensibly challenge the player and then teach them through experience how to succeed in that challenge. So an ideal game doesn't need an instruction manual because the game itself will teach the player. This is called affordance. Or in other words, to summarize affordance, it's basically the idea of form dictates function. Like, if you look at your environment, you basically know what you can do there. Now, of course, this often leads to the dreaded hand-holding, like Phi or Navi and such things, which is equally annoying in game design, because then one has just shoved the instruction booklet into the game, not made the game speak for itself. Not to mention, it is goddamnably annoying to be impeded in the, as mentioned, foundation of gaming, a challenge you learn how to succeed at. Hand-holding takes away the challenge part entirely, rather than teaching you how to meet that challenge. Back to Majora's Mask. In-game hints are available through gossip stones, but themselves require the Mask of Truth, which needs the hookshot likewise to complete the Swamp Spider House. This means that you're in the third quarter of the game before you have access to advice, and getting that advice even then is very annoying because gossip stones are everywhere and don't always offer tips related to their vicinity, not to mention pausing the game and putting the Mask of Truth on, then talking to the stone and going through its introduction blurb takes like 10 seconds before you learn anything, usually something absolutely unhelpful, obvious, or just a flavor detail that has nothing to do with what you're having trouble with. Look at what the game expects you to do to get the stone mask to make the pirate's fortress less obnoxious, and I will repeat that the reward for completionism isn't so much an enjoyable experience as it is an avoided bad experience. First, you need to break the trend of the entire game you've gone through up until that point and explore the canyon. You can't even get in there until you have Epona, so this has only been something you could do fairly recently. First time you play the Song of Time after beating Goat, Tattle tells the player to go to the Great Bay next, so they might not have even looked around the canyon at all. So let's say the player somehow gets the idea to do something the game has never indicated to them and hits the canyon. It's a very barren place, and they'll almost certainly meet the Poe Hunter guy who tells them they can't even enter until they have the mask from the Gorman brothers, which is itself an absolute pain in the ass of a minigame. Plus, he's way up high, and this is, after all, a Zelda game, so clearly the player needs the hookshot, too. The Kana Canyon's entry area is otherwise barren, but there's a graveyard nearby. The game does tell the player loud and clear to awaken Skolkita once they're in the graveyard, and you can get the captain's hat and otherwise explore the graveyard no problem, likely picking up the Song of Storms while around, so the player's likely to have a sense of having done what the graveyard has to offer, and will be coming back later in the game once they've beaten Great Bay Temple, probably. The graveyard is where all the available activities are at. Not the canyon entrance area, so after opening all three graves each night of the game, maybe even snagging the coveted bottle in the process from the Big Poe on the final night, why do they have any reason to go back to the canyon entrance? There isn't even a warp point there. They could very well forget it exists as anything but a generic connection space, since it's just a barren, rocky wasteland. There's not really much to it. So there's no reason for why the player would think to keep poking around there, in other words. Well, let's say for, you know, honestly, I can't even think of a flimsy justification for backtracking out of the graveyard into there. Maybe they visited the canyon on day two and got the captain's hat then, so played the Song of Time to see what day one's grave had to offer, and thus tracked through the canyon again with a distinct purpose and goal in mind, thus no reason to explore the vicinity. Okay, fine. Let's say the player has a fit of delusional madness and thinks that there is in fact a delicious pizza awaiting for them if they search the empty, bland, rocky wasteland canyon area that has generic stone textures in every direction the eye can see save straight upward. In their quest for pizza, assuming our clinically insane player has no other cognitive disorders other than a steadfast certainty that they will be rewarded with pizza for scouring empty space, our player finds a circle of rocks. You know, like how several other areas in the game have rock circles that do absolutely nothing, and they never indicated anything except perhaps the map developers getting bored. As our player, let's call him Pizza Joe, because why not, is already demonstrably insane. Maybe he feels the sudden urge to stand in the middle of those generic rocks that don't look distinctive at all, because rock circles have uselessly appeared elsewhere and did nothing. Pizza Joe has sudden urges to do random things all the time, after all. That's where the restraining order and parole officer came from. But look! Pizza Joe is vindicated! Tattle's turning green over one spot, which means our lovable rogue of a hero, who may have recently obtained the Song of Storms and be wondering if they could do something with it soon, will perhaps try that song. As after all, that is something you could do in Ocarina of Time, to open grottos in some cases. Oh hey, Bombs also did that! Our intrepidly inquisitive lunatic tries that next. Absolutely nothing. If our already psychotic example of a hypothetical pizza fanatic player then thinks to pull out the lens of truth, which was perhaps used 4 times in Snowhead and nowhere else in the game to that point, they will find Shiro, the Invisible Soldier. What is this, Castlevania 2? Is discovering for yourself that this is here, without resorting to a guide or solution elsewhere, something only possible for one of our hypothetical Pizza Joe's mentality? Or perhaps the game should be designed with a premise that the player is not a complete insane asylum internee in mind. It's really the most flagrant example of the game's design, and the part of it I am most openly contemptuous of, but there's other things. Every dungeon besides Woodfall is a pain in the ass with sluggish designs that tend to make the player repeat themselves monotonously, such as with Great Bay Temple's one-way water currents, valves thawing water sources, freezing and thawing water sources repeatedly, and everything about Stone Tower. The Gorman Brothers race requires much higher skill with opponents, such as knowing how the carrot meter depletes and refills based on how many carrots you've used, or if you've depleted the entire meter. Then, any other use of opponent previously in the game, and you don't really use Epona for anything but jumping gates once, at which point you will then be using the Song of Soaring to get to wherever Epona was getting you to. It's an example of the game giving the player a challenge, but not having provided the player with a way to learn how to complete said challenge besides trial and error at said minigame. And the skill taught in the minigame is never used again. More than just the stone mask, several other masks are obtuse as hell. The all-night mask is a weird one, because you can only see it offered on the night of the final day after 10 p.m. in the Curiosity Shop, which is a 2 in-game hour window until the final hour's countdown, and generally a time in which the player wishes to play the Song of Time and save their progress to avoid losing the past few hours of game they've played. Curiosity Shop's wares are almost useless or non-existent otherwise, unless you get your sword stolen by the Tockery Bird. So if the player, perhaps Pizza Joe returning for no validly logical reason, happens to check the Curiosity Shop at 10 p.m. or later on the final day, they will find the bomb bag the player already has. You have to kill or interrupt Sakon on the night of the first day in the North Clocktown Park when he tries to steal the bomb bags from the old lady, or else the Curiosity Shop will be selling that instead of the all-night mask. The player is, of course, never given any indication of this being the case, recognizing a pattern. And recall, you need the Giant's Wallet to even afford the All Knight's Mask. Getting said Giant's Wallet, by the way, it means beating the Ocean Spider House on day one. The only way you'd know that you need to do it on day one, by doing that entire Spider Hunt slog on the more likely day two or day three, and being given absolutely fucking nothing for doing so, besides a woeful admonishment of, oh, if only you'd done that before. It's stupid. There's also the Dongaro frogs, which speaks for itself in Thorne's Heart Piece video, but I think he really didn't show off the sheer monotony of that. 5 frogs from the entire game world, including mini-bosses, and for doing so, you get 1 heart piece. So that having been established, that Majora's Mask as a game to play is, I would say, quite reasonably worse than Ocarina of Time, I'll go over what does make it so fondly remembered. It's an amazing story with characters and lives far deeper than any other on the N64. If you ask me, someone who claims they enjoy Majora's Mask more than Ocarina of Time is referring to the game's writing and atmosphere, not the actual gameplay. If they do insist that Majora's Mask is a more fun game to play than Ocarina of Time, they are a person whose taste in enjoyable activities leads me to believe that I should not heed their opinion. Or they're a hipster, which also means I should not heed their opinion. But I will agree immediately with no hesitation that Majora's Mask's narrative is vastly superior. Thorne's LP has gone over the admirable features and sincerely emotional moments, but I'll cover how the narrative is actually presented rather than the content of that narrative, which Thorne has done. For one thing, the game doesn't just give you a game over screen when you screw up. You see the actual consequences, and that's not something games even today, over 10 years later, do very often, except with a bad ending or otherwise a single cutscene. Fanjun Cafe's side quest isn't done right. You see 2 people who just want to say, I love you, before the world ends, never be able to do so. You see Cafe return to an empty room, knowing he will never see Anju again, that she lost faith in him, and that the woman he's loved all his life is going to die thinking that he abandoned her. That is nothing short of absolute despair, minutes before the moon hits and everybody dies. You see the swordsman, full of bravado previously, shaking and sobbing in the hidden room, because he's been putting up a false front and is so afraid to die. A playful monkey who just wanted to help his friend is boiled alive, and you can see him get dipped in the water, only for his empty, glassy eyes to silently stare ahead at the player when pulled out. I only watched that cutscene once. Ever. Ugh. The Gorons, the goofy and doofy, happy-looking rock-eating buddies, are freezing to death one by one. Several are actually popsicle-fied outright. Gorman drinks himself into a stupor in an empty bar because he can't bring himself to tell the performers he spent his entire life aspiring to lead that they won't even have a show before they all die. And everything they did was pointless. Romani gets lobotomized by them to the point where she is barely aware of her surroundings, and all Cremia can do is blame herself in horrified grief for not listening. And then there's the stuff the game fully implies but doesn't show, which arguably makes them even worse due to being left to our imaginations. If you don't play the Song of Healing in Ikana, that little girl Pamela will see her father transforming into a Gibdo with nothing but more undead waiting outside the door. If she stays, she not only has to watch her father degrade further and further before the end of the world, but may very well join him. If she tries to escape, she'll be torn apart. Lulu never sees her children. The Zora eggs just die. The last thing the giants might ever know is that they promised to protect Termina, failed, and their little friend from the distant past will never know that they still care. What's the last thing one sees after the moon crash sequence, the actual game over? Majora's Mask, slipping away into the dark to inflict this kind of destruction, despair, and suffering upon somewhere else. Probably Hyrule itself, considering Link came from there and Skull Kid was already in there. All of that is what I'd call an incentive for the player to be empathetic to the NPCs, don't you think? But even with that aside, the very nature of the 3-day cycle repeating itself means that the player has a unique situation, repeated dialogue without a new game plus. In other words, since many tasks take multiple cycles, or one is just around particular characters repeatedly, they're not just seeing a character establishing piece of dialogue once in the entire playthrough. They're going to see it multiple times while they're trying to do the same thing with that character, and will have the chance to really examine those characters and get to know them. Plus, importantly, the characters always reward the player for their help if they can, and some of those rewards are extremely useful. Others aren't, obviously, but some are. Sure, heart pieces and one-off masks are frequent, but then there's things like the Chateau Romani milk. You don't just get the intangible, story-based satisfaction of saving the ranch. You get access to infinite magic power for the rest of that cycle. And let me tell you, that is an amazingly useful item for the rest of the game once it's an available option. Great Bay Temple and Stone Tower both guzzle your magic nastily. Having old limited magic meter is genuinely a huge relief. And Thorn even showed how that plays a very important aid in the entire moon sequence, as well as also covered the credits in his final video. The Anjun Cafe quest is so huge and branching that it adds up many smaller rewards rather than one big one at the end. The couple's mask is, after all, only used to get one heart piece, so it in and of itself isn't much, which is kind of strange. You'd think they'd give you something better for the game's biggest side quest. Psychologically, it's almost a how to make the player like you scenario for an NPC. The player is invested in the NPC for both narrative and concrete reward reasons. Remember when I opened this by talking about how narrative and engagement were almost impossible to balance? There you go.